Special Committee on Energy will come to order. The time is 10:22 a.m., February 26, 2015, in room 17. Members present, shall we have roll call? Representative Clayman?
Here.
Representative Palarico?
Here.
Representative?
Here.
Over.
Here.
Hey, Representative.
Representative Tilton, welcome. Let the record reflect that Representative Nagyak has been previously excused. May the record reflect we have a quorum to proceed with the committee's business. And welcome back, everyone. Welcome to the proceedings online. Who's online? Do we know? Do we have? Welcome, Representative Wolf.
Thank you.
All cell phones should be off. The first order of business is a quick update from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation on the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program. We had a presentation several weeks ago, and I had asked an update and follow-up on that. Online, do we have Mr. John Anderson?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to provide an update. I apologize, we're not there in person. For the record, this is John Anderson, Director of Research and Rural Development for Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Mr. Anderson, excuse me, welcome. And for the record, can you please state your position and affiliation?
John Anderson, Director of Research and Rural Development for Alaska Housing.
Okay. By the way, Mr. Anderson, in light of the tight budgetary crisis we face, I'm glad you're appearing telephonically.
Well, thank you. So to provide a little bit of an update on our January 27th presentation, we have forwarded information to the committee of the loan guide regarding the public facility loan program, our white paper that we did on the public facilities. We also provided the executive summary of the 2014 Alaska Housing Assessment Study, AHFC rate rebate and weatherization wait lists and our planned activities for both of those. And we also provided the budgetary summary of where those programs are currently at. Along with that, we provided some additional slides with direct questions from some of the committee members wanting a little bit better of an update on some of those numbers. So I'm not sure if this was put into some type of a format to present or if you'd like to just go into question and answers.
Do the members have the documents he referenced? Short eddies, Mr. Anderson, we're just making sure we have the documents you refer to. Meeting of the Special Committee on Energy is now going to start again. The time is 10:26. We're just going to go on to our next presentation. Mr. Anderson, my Chief of Staff, Josh Walton, is in the process of getting sufficient copies for members of this committee and members of the audience so that they can follow your presentation. I apologize. Can you hold on?
That is okay. Yes, we will stand by.
Okay, thank you, and I apologize for any inconvenience. We're going to proceed with House Bill 58, and first we're going to consider changes in the committee, the CS, adopted last time, and we're going to have testimony on that. Who is... Thank you. For the record, state your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Jonathan Christ-Tompkins, representative for District 35. And today before us, we have a CS for House Bill 58. The substantive change between the CS and the original bill is that it includes additional nonprofit entities. We had a fun sort of discovery of tax code that there are different types of nonprofits and that BFWs and American Legions, for instance, have a different tax-exempt status, and so the CS version of the bill includes nonprofits such as the VFW and American Legions that have this differentiated tax-exempt status. That's the change between the CS and the original version of House Bill 58.
And for the record, can you state the title of this bill?
Yeah, absolutely. This is the committee substitute for House Bill 58, which we're informally referring to Representative Miller.
Representative. Let's take a brief at ease and make sure that the committee members have a copy of the committee substitute. For the record, it is 10:29. You may proceed, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So for clarity, the bill before us being the CS for House Bill 58, and that is version / H is in Hector. And I guess I'm at the committee's disposal for any questions or happy to elaborate on any aspect of the legislation we didn't touch on previously.
Can you explain in more detail what changes are being made?
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
Go page by page.
Sure. And to clarify, these are the changes between the original bill and the CS?
Yes.
Okay. All the changes, to the best of my knowledge, and Miguel and my staff can correct me if I'm misstating this, are found on page 4, lines 17 and 18. And initially, my sort of lay understanding, I think many of our lay understanding as a nonprofit, is a 501c3 in IRS tax code. And it turns out there are different kinds of nonprofits, so there are also 501c19s and 501c12s and 501c6s, all of which are nonprofits but have sort of nuanced differentiation under tax code. So as I mentioned, American Legions and VFWs have a sort of special nonprofit tax status in IRS code, and that's the sum of the changes between the CS and the original House bill.
So basically, page 4, appears to be section 5, subsection J, B3, the definition of tax-exempt identity?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
So that's the change for the record?
That's the change, yeah, including these additional nonprofit tax-exempt entities, such as 501c19s.
Okay. Is there somebody that can tell us exactly what these different identities are, how they differ?
Sure. I think I defer to Miguel, my staff, who's behind me, to go through each of the different tax-exempt entities.
Thank you. Appreciate it. For the record, state your name and affiliation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Miguel Robacher, staff representative, Chris Tompkins.
Thank you. Proceed.
The different tax-exempt entities that are listed are 501c3s are your standard nonprofits that we're all familiar with. That would be like United Way, those kinds of organizations, food banks, 501c3 organizations. 501c4s are 501c4s are community advocacy groups. The League of Women Voters, for example, is a 501c4 organization. A community softball league would be a 501c4 organization. They're different in their activities, but they also have a nonprofit purpose. 501c6 organizations are business representative organizations. For example, chambers of commerce are 501c6 organizations. Trade organizations are 501c6 organizations. 501c12s are utility and agricultural cooperatives. So these would be irrigation cooperatives in the rest of the United States. And in Alaska, the best examples of 501c12 organizations would be the Alaska Village Electrical Cooperative, Golden Valley Electrical Cooperative. cooperative, as well as the Inside Passage Electrical Cooperative Program. And 501c19s are nonprofits that exist for veteran services. The American Legion, or the Veterans of Foreign Wars are the best example.
Does anyone on the committee have any questions? Is there anything else you want to state with regard to this bill?
I don't know.
Thank you. We'll proceed then with, thank you for your testimony. We'll proceed with Stacy Schubert and John Anderson from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. I believe they're online. Hello?
Madam Chair, this is John Anderson with Alaska Housing again. We are available for questions. I don't believe that we have specific testimony regarding HB 58 or the CS.
Okay. Do you have any position with regard to this particular bill?
No, ma'am.
Okay. Any questions? Mr. Anderson, is there any estimate as to the impact this bill would have on the loan fund?
That would be difficult to predict at this point. I believe that we could see an increase of activity, but it's really kind of unknown without it being an actual bill that's been passed and moving forward. Our outreach, I can tell you this, has involved a lot of the entities that are listed through that nonprofit of the tribal entities as far as our ongoing outreach and discussions of our revolving loan program.
Okay. And this program is administered by your office, Mr. Anderson?
That is correct.
And what's the interest rate charged on these loans?
The last project that was approved by our board was a $3.7 million project for the Department of Transportation for multiple locations and multiple buildings, and I believe that interest rate was 3.6%.
Payable over what period of time?
15 years.
Yes. Mr. Anderson, this is Representative Tilton. I have some questions that relate to the entire bill, not to just the change in the CS. Is it all right if I proceed with that?
That's sure.
Okay with everybody?
Yes, please.
So the bill opens up the eligibility for tribal entities, and the CS is adding some different nonprofits to that. That's correct? And I'm just wondering if we had, and maybe this is better to you, Representative Chris Thompson, and I'm sorry that I didn't get to your office to ask you these earlier, but it's my understanding that this fund is sitting there and there are no eligible entities in it that have been awarded the fund at this time. That's correct?
Representative Tilton, through the chair, that's correct, that the fund has been dramatically underutilized to date.
Okay. So if there wasn't any current eligibility, I guess where I'm going with this is that because there was more grants available, so there wasn't the available, you know, so people would go to a grant with a no interest versus going to a loan with interest, and kind of follow along. I'm going down a series of questions. So if we were looking at having nobody who had applied for this, what are you looking at, a need, an increase in the need, or people maybe applying to this? I'm just kind of wondering if we have a loan fund sitting out there that maybe isn't necessary along that. So do you have kind of an idea or any of how many different entities would be now this would be able to open it up for?
Madam Chair, this
yes.
is John Anderson. Can I add something?
Yes, Ms. Anderson.
I apologize.
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, the fund is not sitting there. What SB 220 allowed AHSC to do was provided us with the authority to go out and bond for that entire $250 million. We do not have a fund sitting there. In fact, our intent through our normal financing is to go through these projects until we have enough on our books to actually go out and do the bonding mechanism. So there's not money sitting there. I just wanted to be very clear that it's the authority given to us.
Ms. Anderson, thank you for that important clarification. You may proceed, Representative Tilton.
Oh, thank you. So I think that we may have answered this earlier, but talking about what would the rate of interest be on if these loans, if they weren't able, let's see, what would we be looking at as a rate of interest doing the loans through through Alaska Housing, and what would be a rate that they would have to pay outside if they were able to get a loan outside of that?
This is John Anderson again.
Mm-hmm.
It's a market-driven process, but our last loan that went to our board was at 3.625 over a 15-year period. If there's competing monies that are out there and available, we're by all means willing to work with each one of the departments to make that determination for the best use of the program.
Okay. And also, can I follow up?
Yes, of course.
Are there other funds, what other funds would you say are available that are out there for energy efficiency that would be available for travel entities or nonprofit entities?
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, specific funds we're not aware of any. We're not sure as far as the commercial banking institutes, whether they have funds available or not. We do not believe that there are other financing mechanisms within the state agencies that provide this.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Wills.
Okay, sure. I'll have a question.
Proceed, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How is this program different than the other housing program loans for energy efficiency for a homeowner, for example? Either one.
Mr. Anderson?
Yes, this is John Anderson again. I'm not sure that we can provide an apples-to-apples comparison there. Residential energy-efficient retrofits are, in many cases, a lot more simplified than any type of a commercial project or program when you get into the complexity of the commercial buildings. So on the surface, we believe that they're very similar in concept, that you have an audit done, you go in and do your work, you do a post-audit, you can show what your increase in energy efficiency was. But again, the complexity of commercial buildings is a lot more in depth.
So it's fair to these are. Thank you for the follow up. These are just for commercial and larger projects. I'm getting.
Thank you.
That is correct. It is intended for public facilities.
Okay.
The loan is set up now. Now that could mean anywhere from a 70,000 square foot office building right down to a 2,000 square foot little warehouse in one of the villages. We do have those different classifications across the state, but again, it is intended for a public facility or commercial operations.
Thank you for that clarification.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would also, with adding the tax-exempt entities, I was just wondering, is it possible you have an example of what kind of a project they might be doing? And Representative Crystal, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Representative Tilton, through the chair. For the record, this is Jonathan Christ Tompkins again.
Representative
Jonathan Christ Tompkins, all those syllables. And one of the two prime sponsors of the bill. There's actually an example, and I don't have the list of testifiers for this bill, but I believe someone from the Foraker Group or Cold Climate Housing Research Center may actually speak to a trial project that's being done in Fairbanks right now.
Okay.
That is an example of this sort of cooperative relationship between the a low-interest loan and making energy efficiency improvements for a nonprofit.
Thank you, Representative Pumpkins, and I will wait to hear from them.
Okay.
Mr. Anderson, are there any other pending loans, pending applications?
Madam Chair, we do have the one loan that I just referred to on the Department of Transportation. We have inquiries of about half a dozen more that we are going through that technical review process right now and in communications with some of the other Department of Transportation projects.
Okay. And what efforts have been made to make the agency heads aware of this loan program?
Madam Chair, quite a lot, actually. Over the past couple of years, we have provided presentations to the Rotary Club, Wood Energy, the Alaska Municipal League, the Institute of Architects, REAP, Alaska Association of Facility Administrators. The list goes on, and timing of what's happening for us next week is we're having a very large Energy Efficiency Now conference in Anchorage that has been targeted also to the Municipal League, regional planners, the Alaska Chapter of American Institute of Architects, the Society of Professional Engineers, BOMA. That list goes on and on also. We're anticipating about 100 to 150 people at this conference for a day and a half. And again, any time that we get the opportunity to present on the program, we definitely take that. We internally don't have operating funds for this program, so it does come out of current staff that we currently have to try to address the requests when it comes to the different energy fairs or the home builder meetings and things of that nature. We also met with DOT, and I know our CEO, Brian Butcher, has had conversations with the commissioners of DEED and the Department of Transportation regarding the program.
And Mr. Anderson, can you give the audience and committee members an example of a project that could be financed through this loan program?
Madam Chair, absolutely. I can give you a short version and a long version if you'd like, but anywhere from replacing old fluorescent T12 lights down to new LED lighting systems is a very big savings or a fast savings. Replacing an old boiler that's 50 years old and a 50% efficient boiler in some of these smaller facilities with a new commercial version of a higher energy efficiency of 87-90%. Those type of projects are relatively fast in payback and sometimes very simple to do.
Any other improvements, examples of improvements that can be made?
Madam Chair, absolutely. By removing windows in some of our snow storage facilities for equipment and basically tightening up the envelope and adding insulation, again, better lighting, better controls, and of course more efficient heating and ventilation systems.
Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have one more question, and thanks for bearing with my questions. I just am wondering, the bill itself, then, would it extend this loan program to the for-profit-owned tribal entities? Is Aaron, maybe I need some explanation there, some help with that.
Representative Tilton, through the chair, this is Representative Jonathan Grace Tompkins, for the record. I believe so, actually. So on page 4, line 15 and 16, a business enterprise wholly owned by federally recognized tribes. And I believe we've actually had conversations about this, and I actually have it scribbled down in my notes. I think this is actually something that would entertain a committee amendment on, in exempting business enterprises of tribes. So it's just the sort of service delivery arms of tribes, which is 98% of all tribal activity in Alaska anyway. Yes,
okay.
Right now.
Thank you.
Do you have a fiscal note with this bill?
Madam Chair, there is no fiscal note with this bill.
Okay.
Or a zero fiscal note, I believe.
Okay. Any other questions?
Madam Chair, I'm wondering...
Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'd like to ask the sponsor if he'd object to having a sunset on the eligibility for the nonprofits and tribal entities operate more like a pilot program.
Representative Tallarico, through the chair, I would welcome such an amendment. Obviously, we sort of iterate as we have more discussions and try to create a better policy product. The other point I have in my notes is I think a sunset is one policy option. Another mechanism, I mean, the intent of this fund is to help public facilities, of course, and I think we want to prioritize that mm-hmm. above nonprofits. And so the second sort of possible amendment I had for either a future CS or amendments through this committee is possibly creating a prioritization so that AHFC deals with public entities first, and only once that demand has been satisfied and spoken to, then they deal with nonprofits. So that way, I think the original intent of the fund is honored. And that may be a different means to accomplishing what you described. I mean, if there were a sunset, I think I would partly get at it, but it wouldn't actually speak to the prioritization that I think all of us mm-hmm. feel is important. So I would just offer that as another idea. And also happy to roll that into a future CS.
Representative Tilton?
I'm good. Thank you. Thank you on this. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So would you be willing to provide us some concepts for another CS that we could bring forward later?
Absolutely.
Yeah. We're holding this bill, and we'll mm-hmm. put our heads together. I mean, okay. Some of these issues are well taken, and it sounds like you're receptive to amendments.
Representative Tiger, through the chair, and Madam Chair, absolutely.
And those amendments
thank
would
you.
Take care of my concerns equally,
okay.
So.
Great.
Any other comments or questions with regard to this? No. Okay. For the record, there are no further... Well, I see there may be a comment or question. Representative... Chris Tompkins, do you have any other?
No, I don't, Madam Chair. I believe there may be a few folks online that, for instance, could speak to that pilot project,
yes.
But
okay.
Of course that could be held to a future committee hearing.
Sure. So who do you have online that, or they're not going to be
Madam
participating?
Chair, I don't have a list provided to me by the LIO, but we've been in conversations with Dini Power of World Climate Housing Research.
Okay.
And Chris Rose of Renewable Energy Alaska.
Excuse me, do we know if Mr. Chris Rose, Joe Nehemiah, and Daniel Powers are online? Excellent, super. Then we can proceed.
Great.
Mr. Rose?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chris Rose. I am the Executive Director of Renewable Energy Alaska Project, or REAP. We are a coalition of over 80 organizations across the state, including electric utilities, native corporations, independent power producers, developers, businesses, and NGOs. And we were very interested in the establishment of this loan fund back in 2010 through Senate Bill 220, which at the same time also actually mandated that a certain percentage of the state's public buildings be retrofitted by 2020. So There is a state mandate to actually retrofit, I believe, 15% of the state's public buildings. And we feel this is a very important issue for the state, particularly with the economic situation we have right now. Mm-hmm. I've referenced you to folks to a report that Alaska Housing Finance Corporation published October 29th, 2012. That was version one. They may have updated it since then, but it's a white paper on energy use in Alaska's public facilities. There are over 5,000 public buildings in the state that could take advantage of this current loan program as it stands, and as has been stated several times, unfortunately there has not been a loan that's actually been executed, although some loans have been approved. And there are a number of reasons for that. One of those is probably that there is a grant mentality in this state, and that a lot of folks have probably been waiting for some free money. And as several people have mentioned, those days are certainly over, at least for now. And so we really hope that we can get more public facilities to move toward taking these loans. The state is estimating, HFC estimated in that white paper, that the state is spending about $642 million every year on energy. $642 million every year on energy. If I'm not mistaken, that's close to 10% of the operating budget for the state of Alaska. And if we could do about a 20% savings on that, which we know is possible, if we retrofitted all those buildings, that's $125 million a year, forever, at today's energy prices. So there's a heck of a lot of savings to be wrung out of this. Having said all that, we support the expansion of the program because there are a lot of entities like the 501c3s and 6s and the tribal organizations that aren't eligible now that may be able to get in there and get some of these loans executed. There are issues we hope can also be resolved in making it easier for some of these public facilities to get loans. For instance, school districts, and there's a ton of public schools, are used to budgeting 1 year at a time. So it's very difficult for them to conceive of how to even take a loan. We're hoping that, for instance, the Department of Education can make it easier for school districts to participate in this program. But we support this expansion. We support energy efficiency as Alaska's first fuel, and we support keeping all that money in the state's economy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Rose. Just for the record, I met with Mr. Sheldon Fisher, the acting commissioner of the Department of Administration, and I've made him aware of this loan fund and have asked him to follow up on that. Can you share with him that report and any additional information you have?
Of course. Sheldon Fisher?
Yes. Acting Commissioner of the Department of Administration.
I will do that, Madam Chair.
He is very, he's very focused on making state government more efficient and reducing waste, and of course this falls in that category.
Okay.
Anything else, Mr. Rose?
No, I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Any questions of Mr. Rose? Thank you, Mr. Rose. We'll proceed with our next witness, Joel Neimeyer from the Denali Commission.
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm Joel Neimeyer with the Denali Commission. I'm serving as the federal co-chair, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to House Bill 58. The Denali Commission, in partnership with Rasmussen Foundation and Cold Climate Housing Research Center, has embarked on a pilot effort in Fairbanks that I believe Mr. Powers will speak to after I talk, so I'll let him speak about that. But our investment in that project was to demonstrate the validity of energy audits being predictive, and then carrying out a loan program. So what our interest is once we work out the bugs in Fairbanks, we are very interested in seeing if we can move this to rural Alaska, where, as we all know, the energy costs are very high. So we see this as a potential tool to rolling out to rural Alaska. We see expanding the number of eligible applicants or folks who can access the loans as being a good thing. Our view is the more work that can be done on a community scale, the work can become more efficient and we can reduce costs. So the idea is we would bundle contracts for energy audits, we would bundle contracts for the construction improvements, and then we'd bundle contracts afterwards for post-construction monitoring, make sure that the energy efficiency improvements take. So we see this as a very important tool for rural Alaska, and which is the interest of the Denali Commission, but also I see it as a very important tool in urban Alaska as well.
Any questions for Mr. Niemeyer? Mr. Niemeyer, thank you very much. For the record, there are no questions. We can proceed with our next witness, Daniel Powers from the Cold Climate Housing Research Center.
Hello, my name is Daniel Powers. I'm up here in Fairbanks, Alaska at Cold Climate Housing Research Center. I'm working on a project called the Fairbanks Nonprofit Retrofit Pilot, which you've heard a little bit about. Very generally, the principle of our pilot project, one of them, was that Alaska is stronger when nonprofits and tribal organizations spend less money on energy. So we've been crafting a project to try to help solve the statewide issue of energy efficiency in nonprofits and tribal organizations. As mentioned before, we're doing it up here in Fairbanks. So we have 14 nonprofit and tribal entities that are going through the process of getting an energy audit, doing an initial walkthrough of their building, getting lined up with contractors, doing the technical assistance and programming that's needed to really digest a very technical document like an energy audit, and then developing five-year plans and building strategies for these building owners so they can start to digest what a return on investment looks like for them. Obviously, if nonprofits aren't going to be in their buildings in 5 years, it's really difficult to have a conversation about energy efficiency lending. So as that process is moving forward, we're taking a look at the expansion of financing throughout that marketplace, and I think that it offers some really great advantages. Namely, it could reduce capital requests from nonprofits and tribal buildings to the state in a time of stressed budgets. Can, as we spoke about, change the grant-based culture for energy efficiency projects, so really turning the corner into the lending area, and then enable nonprofits and tribal organizations to reduce their operating costs in a cash flow positive way. And so as mentioned before, we're doing this project, but as we work through each one of our cohort participants, we're capturing information from them about barriers to lending in their worlds, some of the barriers the auditors see, the barriers the lenders see, and a lot of the barriers that the funders see. And so by the end of the year, we will have a really good understanding of that, but what we do know is that access is one of those barriers, and HB 58 does a really good job of expanding state resources to the organizations that really provide essential services to our citizens. So I really am supportive of this effort, and know it's only one way to help solve the issue of high energy costs in these among these organizations. It's definitely a step in the right direction, and I'm very supportive of it. So thank you for the opportunity to speak, and I'd be very happy to answer any questions anyone may have.
Any questions? Representative Bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. These 14 projects that you're working on right now, what's your timeline on that? Are you just beginning? Have you started any work on them? What's your progress on those?
Yeah, thank you, Representative. Well, you're probably very familiar with many of these organizations, as they're all around Fairbanks. We've had audits completed last year, and we've been in the process of digesting these, discussing them, getting third-party estimates on the recommendation costs, getting contractor quotes. We've had one loan processed and construction completed, boilers installed, and energy monitoring on that project is ongoing. And that's at Fairbanks Resource Agency. So you're probably familiar with them. They're a multi-facility organization that operates primarily through as a service provider for mentally disabled adults. And so they have 12 facilities scattered around Fairbanks, mostly residential, but the one building we worked with them on was their office building. And so they were in need of some new boilers and decided to take out a loan using our financing mechanism through a financial intermediary to take the long view and invest in some energy efficient Badaris 87% efficient boilers, two large commercial boilers, and then they also redid their pumps, so they have smart pumps, reduced their electrical load on their pumps as well, and so we expect to see energy savings there. Still processing a number of recommendations that came from audits last year. Those include insul foaming, a lot of like Vertex polyurethane insul foam on the bottom of a crawl space, and it also involves another project that's looking quite promising, that's extending the hot water line onto an adjacent property of one of our participants in the pilot. So by replacing their boiler and going on to the city's hot water, they can save a considerable amount of energy and cost. So so we really have about, of the 14, we have about 7 nonprofits that are still in the decision-making process of whether their board and building committees can digest this, whether they can, what threshold for lending they're willing to take, whether that's a 3-year payback for recommendations or 5 years. We're seeing very few getting, considering anything above 7 years, so that limits the recommendations that people are willing to consider. But I would say this construction season will be a really big push for us to get as many projects processed through the financing we've lined up with our partners at the Denali Commission and Rasmussen Foundation.
Thank you. One follow-up, please.
Sure.
Mr. Rose previously just said the number of 20% savings across the state if these energy efficiency programs were put in place. Do you find your experience that to be an accurate ballpark? Maybe you don't have enough data in on these projects, but is that an attainable goal, do you think?
I don't. You're absolutely right. I do not have enough information to definitively say 20%. It depends on the building. It depends on the audit. I've looked at 15 audits recently, and many of them consider up to 30% return. It's just a matter of how quickly you expect to repay it just from the positive cash flow of energy savings. So I think you can achieve 30% or 20% or 15% energy efficiency savings. It's just a matter of how hard you're willing to work and how much you really want to wring the towel to get your energy savings out. Obviously, there's an economy or a point of diminishing return, and that's something our pilot is really tasked with and was asked by the Denali Commission to sort out, is where is the economy in the retrofit marketplace, so you're finding the sweet spot and then not over-investing to only get a small amount of return, but finding the right place, whether that's 20% or 15%, is still to be determined.
Okay, thank you for your answer.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Powers, and we will proceed with our next witness, Mr. Chandler Kent from Haynes. No, I'm sorry. Mr. Dave Meeser from Fairbanks Tenena Chiefs Conference. Did I pronounce?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Dave Meeser, and I work as the Rural Energy Coordinator for Tenena Chiefs Conference, a nonprofit tribal consortia based here in Fairbanks that works with 42 different federally recognized tribes in the interior of Alaska. I'd like to speak today in strong support of the modifications to the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Fund that have been proposed through HB 58. My region sees electricity costs that range from nearly a dollar a kilowatt hour in one community to costs that are nearly two times the national average here in Fairbanks. Energy efficiency projects that I've led across the interior have saved school districts, clinics, tribes, and cities tens of thousands of dollars in energy costs. Expanding who has access to funding for energy efficiency projects is a key part of making sure that entities have access to funding for retrofitting facilities in a cost-effective manner. The changes proposed by HB 58 ensure that more entities in rural Alaska and here in Fairbanks and across the state have access to this important funding, which was set aside for good reason, but is clearly going unutilized. Tenena Chiefs Conference is a nonprofit that would benefit from this legislation change. We operate more than 200,000 square feet of clinic and office space here in Fairbanks, and audits that have been done on many of our facilities, but access to low-cost funding for these retrofits is one of the missing pieces. TCC fully supports the proposed legislation and any legislation that makes energy efficiency funding easier to access for nonprofit entities struggling with a high cost of energy. By spending money wisely to reduce energy costs, nonprofits like TCC can use that money to better serve our clients, Alaskans who are in need of help. I'd also like to add that in response to some of the comments I've heard in this conversation, that technology change in general takes time. And from my observation working in the energy field, the implementation of energy efficiency is no different. Just as I've seen more wind turbines and more solar panels prove out and lead to more wind turbines and more solar panels, I believe that good examples of successful energy efficiency projects will lead to more entities looking to take advantage of this money to implement more projects. Mm. Thank you so much for your time.
Any questions? For the record, I see no questions. Thank you very much for testifying. I have two issues, and they're not going to be resolved. I do have, before I proceed, I do have available for questions Mr. Chandler Kent from Haynes and his staff to Representative Chris Tompkins. So if anybody has a question of this individual, they can proceed with the question. For the record, I see no questions. I'll go back to what I was stating. There are two concerns I have, and we'll need to work on these. My concern, Mr. Anderson testified earlier that there may be not enough staffing to consider these loans. We may have a lot more activity. It appears they haven't had much activity to date, but if they do, we'll have to discuss with them how they plan to add additional staff or move around staff so they can consider these loan applications in a timely manner. I mean, we all know how short our construction season is and our, window of opportunity is here in Alaska. My other concern is safeguards, and here again we'll have to coordinate and discuss with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, the safeguards to minimize defaults. In one of my previous lives, I was an assistant attorney general, and basically I did commercial litigation and cleaned up after a lot of defaulted loans that were owed to the state. So having that experience, I'm well aware that things can go wrong. So I'd like to see what safeguards and if we need to do a pilot project to see how well these loans are going, that may be a possibility. So, but I think we'll probably can work these things out. I would like to thank the sponsor. We're going to be holding the bill in order to consider amendments in these issues. And I'd like to thank the sponsor who testified and everyone that testified. and we will contact Representative Chris Tompkins when we will have another hearing on this bill.
Okay.
Sure.
Madam Chair, for the record, Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins, and just to make sure my notes are in accord with the committee's, there's a couple of revisions that I think we want to explore that have come up since this last CS version H was drafted by Legislative Legal. And in the first, which I think speaks to the first of the 2 points you mentioned, Madam Chair, and also the point that you mentioned, Representative Tallarico, is creating sort of a prioritization structure so that public facilities are guaranteed and ensured first priority access to the revolving loan fund. And the second is sort of clarifying the line between nonprofit and for-profit with tribal enterprises versus tribal nonprofits that deliver social services and services to Alaskans. And then regarding the default safeguards that you mentioned, Madam Chair, we'd be eager to explore that and talk with the HFC about how we might be able to best approach that issue.
And staffing issues, if that becomes an issue.
Absolutely. Thank you, though, for the opportunity to present, for your questions, and I think this will ultimately make the legislation a better bill.
Thank you. Well, we'll close public testimony on HB 58. Are you comfortable with that? With that, we'll have a short at ease to prepare for the next bill. Thank you. Please call back to order. For the record, it is 11:22 a.m. It's February 26th. We will proceed to consider House Bill 78. At our last hearing, we heard the introduction of the bill and heard some public testimony on the bill. We will continue to hear testimony on this bill. We have several witnesses on the line, and we will proceed with the one that are long distance. Our first witness will be, and for the record, House Bill 78. Can somebody read into the record the title of the bill? Representative Wolf.
Thank you. An act bearing the short title of the Alaska Competitive Energy Act of 2015 and relating to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska.
Thank you. We will proceed with our first witness, Mr. James Bertrand. Mr. Bertrand? He's calling in for
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you for making time for this. We understand you're on vacation in Mexico.
Yes, Madam Co-Chair, I am in Zihuatanejo.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you. For the record, state your complete name and your affiliation and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. My name is James Bertrand. I'm a partner with the law firm of Stinson Leonard Street and co-chair of its energy division. Our firm has offices in 14 cities in 8 different states. I'm testifying today on behalf of Chugach Electric Association, an electric association in Anchorage a co-op, I should say, in Anchorage that I've worked with for several years.
Okay. Mr. Burt.
My experience is, pardon me?
No, you can proceed. I think you're going to state what I was going to ask you, your experience in the energy area.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I have been working with in the electric energy space since 1988. I have worked with independent power producers, investor-owned utilities, electric cooperative association utilities, and municipal utilities throughout my career. I am experienced in the issues related to the federal regime for promoting energy efficiency and typically through the use of small independent power producers as well as large independent power producers. I'm familiar with the restructuring of the transmission systems, including universal system operators or independent system operators, and how that has impacted competitive issues for independent power producers and utilities. And then finally, I'm also familiar with the proposed regulations that are being considered by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to bring into compliance or harmony Alaska regulations with the structure, the federal structure. I'm here today on behalf of Chugach, but mostly as a resource to answer questions that the committee might have.
Oh, okay. So you don't have a specific presentation or comments to make on this bill?
I do have a few comments I could make, but I was led to believe that I should be available mostly for questions.
And technically? So
whatever you would prefer.
Okay. Well, then, we'll, if you can stay on the line, we'll proceed with our next person, Carolyn Elefant from Washington, D.C. She's with the Alaska Independent Power Association.
Yes. Good morning, Madam Co-Chair. Can everybody hear me?
Yes, you're clear.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. How would you like me to proceed?
Yes.
My name?
Yes.
An
affiliation.
My name is Carolyn. Hi. My name is Carolyn Elefant, and I am owner of the Law Office in Washington, D.C., which is a firm that focuses on energy regulatory issues. I started my legal career in 1988 at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is a federal agency that regulates transmission and wholesale power sales for utilities that are connected to the interstate grid. And so, effectively, that's mostly states in the lower 48, except for Texas, which is kind of a quirky exemption. During my career, I've had an opportunity to observe how known as the Public Utilities Regulatory Policies Act, and also the emergence of open access transmission have transformed the electric utility industry and led to robust competition and innovation and lower costs for consumers. And in fact, today, at least in the lower 48, one of the trends that we're seeing now is we're moving towards a further modernization of the utility industry and moving into what's known as Utility 2.0, which, in addition to independent supply from independent power producers, also a lot of self-generation that is being incorporated into the grid through net metering and distributed generation. I have been involved in proceedings both at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and state commissions dealing with competitive markets and filed comments on these different rulemakings. And I've also been somewhat involved with the regulatory proceeding before the Regulatory Commission of Alaska that has been making some of the changes to its implementation of PURPA. I do have some prepared comments if you would like me to proceed. My comments are prepared on the legislation. If I can go ahead with that or if you would like.
Yes, yes, you may proceed.
Okay. So as I was saying, I have observed these various changes in the electric utility industry in my part of the country and also in the lower 48 that has resulted from the implementation of PURPA and open access transmission policies. I understand that some of the energy concerns here in Alaska are a little bit different. There is a harsh climate. There are rural and remote communities. And so there is some difference between some of the issues that we have here, which are related more to congestion on transmission lines and also very complex competitive power markets. But at the same time, Alaskan ratepayers face some of the highest electricity rates in the country, despite a wealth of natural resources such as wind, hydropower, marine hydrokinetic, and solar, just to name a few. And if these technologies and were exploited and brought to market, it would help to reduce rates and, equally importantly, increase the diversity of power supply and foster competition. But unfortunately, without incentives for private investment, many of these resources really remain untapped. So what will it take to attract financing for new technologies? Quite simply, what's needed are competitive energy markets, and in turn, competition depends on the availability of three factors, I would say. Access and opportunity for independent power producers and non-utility generators, and also transparency. So in my testimony, I'm going to discuss very briefly how some of the federal laws and regulations and state policies have created access, opportunity, and transparency, which has driven investment in the utility industry. And I'll talk a little bit about how the Competitive Energy Act, which this committee has support today, will align the law in Alaska with many of the policies that have already contributed to competitive success in on federal level and in many states. So what I wanted to talk about a little bit to start off with is this statute, the Public Utilities Regulatory Policies Act, which we call FERPA. So this is probably, in the context of things, this is sort of like the great-grandfather grandmother of competitive power markets, And even though the name of this statute is somewhat complicated and clunky, the concept is really simple. Essentially, what it did to open competition was to require utilities to purchase power from smaller non-utility generators, which are known as qualifying facilities. Utilities would be only be required to pay the same price as if they bought the power from another utility or self-generated. And so, in other words, they would basically pay the cost that they would otherwise avoid if they, by purchasing from qualifying facilities, they would avoid the cost of buying that power elsewhere. And so that's how you come up with this terminology of avoided cost. And one of the, there were two goals behind FERPA. It was intended to stimulate competition, but it was also supposed to be ratepayer neutral. When you use avoided costs, you are ensuring that ratepayers are not paying any more for power than they would if the utility generated it itself. And so that's another one of the driving forces behind FERPA. At the same time, FERPA recognized that even if utilities are required to purchase power, it doesn't do much good if there's no way to deliver the power to market. And so there were regulations that were implemented that directed the states to develop robust interconnection policies to make sure that qualifying facilities get access to interconnection. And in fact, states were actually given this role because the authors of FERPA anticipated at that time that it would just be too complicated to have states try to have the qualifying facilities try to, and independent power try to interconnect through federal policies. So, you know, at this point I've talked about how FERPA gives access to markets and also opportunity for independent companies to compete. But the last thing is even with those characteristics, projects that are built ultimately have to be financially feasible to attract private investors because FERPA is fostering private investment, not government-subsidized investment. And so one thing investors want to know when they invest in a project is whether they're going to make any money and get a decent rate of return. And in order to determine that, PURPA requires utilities information that are avoided costs available. And with that information, potential investors can decide whether a project is going to be financially attractive or not. So as I said, PURPA's been in effect for 35 years, and during that time, it's been criticized. There have been many, many attempts to eliminate it. Some have argued that competition has already been achieved and PURPA is not necessary. But PURPA is sort of what you might call a Teflon statute, and it is somewhat impervious to this opposition. In 2005, Congress rolled back FERPA to some degree. It said that for utilities that are in markets that are already competitive, they can apply to FERC to ask to terminate this mandatory purchase obligation, at least for larger independent projects. But FERPA made very clear, even with these changes, that in parts of the country where you don't have competitive markets, there was still a need for a statute like FERPA. And Alaska right now is at a point where really there are not yet competitive markets. And so the same rationale that motivated Congress to keep part of FERPA in place back in 2005 with these amendments also applies in Alaska. The last point I wanted to mention is FERPA really isn't the only law that provides access to the grid to independent power. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission also regulates the nation's transmission grid, and in 1996 it issued what was known as Order 888, which essentially required all utilities to provide open access to their transmission on a non-discriminatory basis. So if the utility was going to transport its own power over its lines, it had to make that access available to independents on the same terms and conditions. Order 888 was really a landmark order, and in the 20 years since then, robust power markets have evolved, new technologies have developed, and have been brought to grid, brought to market, and it has really provided many benefits. It's also contributed to to economic development in various states, which have decided to, which have become known for certain resources like wind or solar, and so it's really been quite a benefit. And so, with this legislation that the committee is considering today, Alaska can enjoy those same competitive benefits that have been obtained in other jurisdictions. Again, this bill accomplishes those same three characteristics, the access, opportunity, and transparency that have furthered competition in other markets. Just briefly, one of the ways that the bill provides opportunity is it ensures that independent power producers have the ability to sell power into the grid, and that is also, I understand the Regulatory Commission of Alaska has also made some other changes to reinforce the requirements of FERPA. The bill provides access. It talks about providing non-discriminatory access to transmission. So essentially, it mirrors the type of open access policy that's been in effect on the federal level for almost 20 years. And finally, and very encouragingly, it provides transparency on avoided costs and also on interconnection costs and integration costs, which is actually a very far-sighted requirement, because there are even some state jurisdictions, some states which don't yet require transparency on integration costs. So with these features in place, this legislation will do what similar legislation has done in other parts of the country, which is to promote competition, diversify, and ultimately lower rates for consumers. I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee may have, and thank you very much for the opportunity to make a presentation.
Representative Colbert.
Thank you. What distinguishes Alaska's transmission systems from the ones in the lower 48? What's the difference? Why are they unique? And maybe you could point out some of the strengths and weaknesses of both.
Okay. Well, I guess, I guess one of the differences, first of all, is really just a regulatory difference. In the lower 48, transmission is something that's regulated on the federal level because it involves interstate interconnection. So you have, you have the transmission system, which is regulated by the federal government, and then you've got distribution systems, which are sort of lower power lines, which are regulated by the states, basically the lines that are transporting the power to homes. So here in Alaska, you really have full control over the whole system from the transmission access to the end user. I suppose in some parts of the country, in some parts of the lower 48, there's additional interconnection for transmission. I know there may be need for expansion. And one of the issues in the lower 48 in some places is that there is transmission congestion. There's too much power flowing through on the lines, and so there's a need to sort of figure out ways to manage that congestion in a way that's fair to users of the system. I must confess I'm not sufficiently familiar enough with Alaskan transmission to know if congestion is a problem. I know the population is certainly smaller, but there may also be fewer transmission lines in place. So I guess that would be another potential difference. And I guess those are some of the key characteristics that I can think of off the top of my head. I don't know if you had any other specific questions about the differences or...
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Klayman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a couple of questions. The first is, you talked a lot about the federal PURPA law, and can you very briefly describe differences between this HB 78 and the PURPA law?
Well, I guess what HB 78 does is really it aligns between HB 78 and also some of the regulatory changes, which I believe Teresa Clemmer is going to discuss. They really help to bring the Alaska into alignment with what PURPA is already doing. So I don't think that HB 78 replaces PURPA, but I think it ensures that that the important components of PURPA are complied with. So, for example, HB 78 requires utilities to make their avoided costs available so that independent power producers can predict, what rates they're going to get if they sell power to a utility, and their investors can figure that out as well. So that's something that brings the statute into alignment with what's being done on the federal level. In terms of interconnection, PURPA does talk about the importance of non-discriminatory interconnection, and this statute does too. And what I like about this statute is that I think it takes it even a step farther, because it does talk about integration costs and, looking to see what they are and trying to come up with a fair way to allocate both the costs and benefits of integration. So I think that's very... very forward-looking, and I think that could potentially be a model for how integration is done in the lower 48. And I guess the other those were some of the key points. Oh, and then in terms of transmission access, so this actually this legislation also gives qualifying facilities access. To transmission, that's a little bit different from PURPA, just because usually QFs have access to both distribution and transmission. A lot of the for some types of independent power, it's actually they get access to transmission under Order 888, but that's just because of the way, again, because of the federal system and the interconnection to the grid.
And then one follow-up through the chair. You made reference to how PURPA has been in place for about 35 years, and I periodically, I'm not sure you mentioned it, but I've heard people reference, there's this potential that we're going to get sued to force us to comply with PURPA, but we've been 35 years without a lawsuit, and I think you've identified that there's this nexus in PURPA with interstate commerce, which is why it's binding on the states, but Alaska being quite a distance from the lower 48, we tend not to have that interstate commerce issue, and I'm just wondering if you think there's a meaningful potential that after 35 years somebody's likely to sort of waltz in and sue about why we aren't complying with PURPA.
So first, I just wanted to clarify something. PURPA actually does apply to states that are not tech interconnected to the grid. So it's by its terms, FERPA applies in Alaska and Hawaii. It applies in Texas and even, Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands. So it's a little bit different. The reason that the Alaska is sort of exempt from a lot of the federal requirements like open access, the source of Order 888 and open transmission access is found in the Federal Power Act, is because the Federal Power Act applies to transactions in interstate. And so Alaska and Hawaii are considered not to be connected to interstate commerce. I mean, I hope that's not insulting. It's a geographic imperative. So PURPA is a little bit different, and the fact that Alaska is not regulated under the Federal Power Act, I don't think would enable it to make a case, for not being subject to PURPA. But that said, certainly, a lawsuit or an enforcement action is a very extreme step. And the way that something like that typically happens is parties will go to FERC and they will say to FERC, hey, this state isn't complying with FERPA, can you do something about it? And FERC will issue a ruling and they'll either say, yes, we agree with you, they're not in compliance. And then FERC has the option of actually bringing the suit in federal court. So it's really FERC that would, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, that would bring the lawsuit. And FERC has only on one occasion ever said that it is going to bring a lawsuit against the state for being non-compliant. And that was with a couple of cases out of Idaho, which were, they're a very unique sort of quirky set of cases. So, a party can also go to federal court, bring a lawsuit, and that if FERC declines to bring an enforcement action, the party can go forward and bring the action itself. It doesn't happen that frequently. I can leave it at that. And these suits really don't happen that frequently. So I don't know what the risk is or who's been talking about the where the source of information has come, but I'll just say that certainly there might be some sort of opportunity, but realistically these cases really aren't brought there very much, and they're very difficult to bring.
There's a quick sure. So if we try to summarize what you just said about the risk of a lawsuit, I think you described it as an extreme step, and would broadly characterize your testimony as that such a lawsuit seems pretty unlikely.
Yes. That said, I think that there are many benefits to adopting this statute, as opposed to sort of the negative, well, let's do it so we don't get sued. I think there are potentially many positive benefits that would flow from this, irrespective of whether a lawsuit is likely.
Okay. I have some questions. You mentioned avoided costs. Can you explain to the audience and the committee members what avoided costs is?
Yes, I'm sorry, I had passed over that very quickly. So essentially when a utility has to supply power, it can either generate it itself, or sometimes the utility might buy power from another utility and pay for that power and then pass it on to its ratepayers. So under PURPA, if a utility is able to buy power from an independent, from a qualifying facility, which is basically a small independent power producer, so if the utility can buy the power from them, it's avoiding, it doesn't have to self-generate, and so it's avoiding the cost of self-generation, or it's avoiding having to buy from another utility. So avoided cost is essentially the cost that the utility avoids paying as a result of purchasing from the qualifying facility. And that's really the cap on what a utility is required to pay a qualifying facility. So if a qualifying facility says, I want to be paid, $100 for a kilowatt hour and the going rate is, 10 cents, there's no obligation in FERPA that the utility has to pay that crazy high amount. It really just has to pay whatever it would be paying otherwise. And so, again, the purpose of that is to ensure ratepayer neutrality so that ratepayers are sort of held harmless. No matter what the utility does, if it self-generates or if it buys from a qualifying facility, ratepayers don't bear the extra cost.
And what do you mean by transparency and avoided costs?
Okay, so with transparency, you know, when you're talking about what a utility if you're talking about what a utility pays to buy power from another utility, sometimes that information is public. You know, the contract may be subject to regulatory approval, and so you might be able to find out, you know, what they're paying under the contract. But if the utility is self-generating, if the utility is building its own facility, its own generating facility to supply power to its customers, it's really hard to figure out what their true costs are with that. And if you don't know what the utility's costs are in building that generation, it's hard to figure out if you're a qualifying facility what you're going to be paid. So by transparency, I mean, you know, under the statute, utility is required to disclose that information. And, you know, they're required to say this is what it costs us. You know, if we build this facility ourselves, this is what it's going to cost us. If we buy it here, this is what it costs us. And so it's really just required to put this cost information out so that these other companies can evaluate whether they can build a project that will match that. Not all independent power producers are going to be able to compete. Some of them, you know, have very efficient technologies and can meet those prices, but others can't. And, you know, if they know the avoided costs, presumably they're not going to go forward with the project if it doesn't look like it's going to make it financially feasible.
And for the record, what is integration costs?
Okay. So integration costs are the costs that might be incurred in introducing certain types of power into the system. So, for example, sometimes if you are relying on a power source like that is maybe dependent on weather, something like wind, you might have to pay another generator to provide a standby service, you know, for a time when the wind isn't blowing. And so that's considered to be, so that cost, that, you know, that backup cost of having that generator available, not the power that the generator is selling, but just, you know, having it there on standby, the cost associated with that, that's, you know, one type of integration cost. And so that's one type of, you know, integration cost. And again, it doesn't, the integration costs can, you know, vary depending on what type of technology, what type of power is being sold and is being sold. So those are what, you know, that's just generally speaking what integration costs are.
How does this bill add transparency to integration costs?
Well, I believe there is a provision in the legislation, and let me I've got it here in front of me, that talked about providing information. Let me I've got to find a section of it now. Bear with me. For the section, I believe there has been a section that talks about how utilities could not just, you know, say, you know, that something is going to be the integration cost. Let's see. What's it? I'll find it now.
24.
Okay. Just look for one more minute.
Yes. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the
record. For some reason,
okay.
I'm not now finding this
okay.
Provision. I thought there had been a provision in here that.
Okay, that's fine. Representative
yeah.
Wilson.
Excuse me. I apologize for not being able to pull that information quickly.
Okay. Representative Wilson wants to make a statement.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Representative Wilson, District 3. We do have a local attorney who will probably be able to answer your questions, Madam Chair, about the Alaska issues and how they go in there okay. specifically so that you might be able to move along quicker if you need to. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions of this witness? Yes, Representative Wolf.
Thank you. I just have a quick question, or maybe two, but just to try to understand this regulations and enforcement and such. PURPA is a set of regulations, federal regulations, and FERC is the agency that's regulating those regulations, enforcing those regulations. Is that correct?
Okay, so it's a little, PURPA is a federal law, and essentially it's one of these laws that encourages sort of this federal-state cooperation. So PURPA is a federal law, and FERC put in place some regulations that sort of set these federal parameters. Like FERC has, for example, FERC has a regulation that says, that reinforces that utilities have to pay avoided costs or that interconnection has to be non-discriminatory. But then each state is actually responsible for implementing its own PURPA program. So, for example, if there's a transaction between a utility and a qualifying facility, if there's a contract, FERC doesn't look at that contract. A state would either look at the contract or a state would say, oh, we're not going to look at these types of contracts. So a state can adopt regulations to implement PURPA, but they have to be consistent with those parameters that that FERC set. So, like, if a state said, we're implementing PURPA, but we think that a utility should have to pay five times avoided costs when it buys from a qualifying facility, that would be something the state couldn't do because that would conflict with the federal parameter saying avoided cost is the metric that you use.
Okay, thank you. Follow up, please. So, my other understanding was that FERC is a federal regulatory agency that, but because Alaska is not connected to the rest of the country, these regulations don't apply up here. Is that correct?
Well, there's two main statutes that FERC administered. One's called the Federal Power Act, and that's what gives FERC the authority over power transactions that are connected to the interstate grid. So that was like the source of FERC's authority to have open access, to require utilities that are connected to the grid. So basically utilities in the lower 48 to provide open access. So that's sort of one category of transactions that FERC has authority over. And any time FERC acts under the Federal Power Act, it doesn't apply to Alaska and it doesn't apply to Hawaii because they're not connected to the grid. But there's a second type of transaction, the ones under PURPA, which is separate from the Federal Power Act. And PURPA, basically in PURPA, Congress said PURPA applies in Alaska, it applies in Hawaii. So PURPA, the source of the authority for PURPA is the Interstate Commerce Act, but it was extended to Alaska and Hawaii because Congress had the ability to do that. And so for transactions that come up under PURPA, those do apply to Alaska, and Alaska does have to comply with those.
Any other questions?
One more unrelated. Oh, we're almost out of time.
No.
But I have one more question, if I may, Madam Chair.
Yes.
You mentioned congestion earlier.
Yeah.
And is FERC the entity that would regulate or manage the overall amount of, I don't know how to ask this. If the system's congested, who's the entity that would say there's too much power in this area right now, and we don't need another entity applying power to this area?
Okay, so the way that would work, again, in the areas that are subject to FERC, and so that's the type of thing that's the type of question that that FERC would not have control over in Alaska. But the way it works in the lower 48 is we have two types of markets. There's some out to the country where there are organized markets, and those are governed by an independent organization called the Regional Transmission Organization. So that group kind of governs the transmission and wholesale power in that market. And it's a bit complex. So if it reaches a point where it looks like there's too much power, they've got all kinds of algorithms and price signals in place so that bids into that market won't clear. And it's sort of done in a very almost like a mathematical algorithm type way. So that's how it works in those organized markets. In other parts of the country, I think somewhere like Idaho or Georgia, the Southeast, where you don't have these organized market operators, it's really the utilities. They engage in resource planning. They identify what their needs are for power, and ultimately they make the decision as to whether there's enough power or not. So, so in those parts of the country, there is the utility that is ultimately making the decision.
Any other
Thank you.
Questions? Okay, it's noon right now. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Okay. We will hold the bill for further consideration at a later hearing, and I'm planning to take it up again next Tuesday, March 3rd. We will proceed first thing with this bill, continue with the public testimony, and a section-by-section analysis, and if need be, we will continue through Thursday. This concludes the business for today, and the House Special Committee on Energy will convene. It will be adjourned until 10:15, Tuesday, March 3rd, here in Capitol Room 17. Thank you.